for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com. My guest today is Allie Iberle. Allie grew up in Maryland. After high school, she moved to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina to attend Coastal Carolina University. She earned a bachelor's degree in marine science with a biology minor. After undergrad, she moved to Charleston to settle down. She took a break from school to start a family and then started her master's degree in 2017. She has since completed the online environmental science and policy degree at Johns Hopkins University. For her master's thesis, she partnered with Dr. Chip Collier at the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. After completing her degree, she was hired by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council to work on the Fishery Grant. Fishery is one of the South Atlantic Council's citizen science projects. The project uses historic dockside photos from Daytona Beach from the 1940s to the 1970s to paint a picture of the fishery before dedicated monitoring programs began. It will harness the power of the crowd by using crowdsourcing platform Zooniverse. Volunteers will view the photos and identify the species present. From this, they'll be able to get species composition, relative frequency of some species, and a rough catch per unit effort. When Allie is not working with fish, she's usually trying to catch them. She lives right outside the city of Charleston and splits her time between the saltwater and Lake Moultrie. Welcome to the podcast, Allie. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So you've just launched this Fishery project.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this effort by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council?
Fishery is a really interesting project, and it's kind of the first of its kind for the council. We have this opportunity to mine information from these historic dock photos. So like you mentioned, the photos range from the 1940s through the 1970s. In the 1970s is when we started these dedicated stock monitoring programs, and they were gathering information on the status of fish stocks within the South Atlantic. But before the state, we really don't know that much about the status of these stocks. The fishery photos really represent a bank of data to help fill these gaps. Because we have so many photos, and we really want people to be able to see the photos, we're using citizen science to have people help us identify the species in the photos. To accomplish that, we're using Zooniverse. And if you've never been on Zooniverse, I really urge you to visit. You can get involved with all different types of projects, anything from formations in space to identifying animals on trail cameras in Africa. The platform will allow us to reach everybody and get everybody involved in looking at these photos and identifying fish.
So I think that was one of my first questions, actually, was why did you and when the council was designing this project decide that using a citizen science approach was going to be more effective than hiring a few experts to look over all these photos?
So we have around 1,300 photos. Just the labor and the cost of having an expert sit down with these photos would be really labor intensive and expensive. And I think the other reason that we turned to citizen science is because we wanted to be able to share these photos. If you fish or you catch fish or you like fish, there really are a treat to look through. Or if you're just wanting to kind of soak up the nostalgia of looking at pictures, you know, from this time period. So I think the citizen science platform was a perfect opportunity for this project.
There's been a lot of talk in the academic literature about sort of shifting baselines and how the normal has changed over the decades. Do you think that this project might help people to realize that in a lot of cases, fish have been getting smaller and catches have been getting smaller?
Yeah, for sure. And I think as we look at the data and as these data come through, that's one thing that I definitely wanted to look at. And I've been thinking about, you know, as we've been developing the project, is how these catches differ from then to now. Another kind of interesting aspect is what they were targeting. Because I know in some of the newspaper articles that we had that accompanied these photos, they talk about the interest in sailfish kind of ramping up. So during this time period, sailfish wasn't really seen as a targeted species. And these captains started writing about how they really enjoyed starting to try to really target sailfish. So I think that shifting baseline and kind of looking at where the effort lies is something that would be really interesting to do with this project.
Yeah, that's going to be another place that might be pretty challenging because, of course, this is fishery dependent data in the sense that you're only looking at what was captured and returned to the dock, right? You're not looking at an overall population, but it does give you some sense of the fish that were being captured in the fishery at that time.
100%. And, you know, we have no information on, you know, what was discarded in these trips. I assume very little because at this time there wasn't many regulations that prevented you from bringing fish back to the dock.
Even today, there are species that don't have many regulations, but people don't consider them valuable enough to keep. So there could be ones out there, but who knows? That would be a really interesting history lesson in and of itself, what people did and didn't consider worth eating.
When you look at the photos, a lot of times they brought back to the dock things that you wouldn't think that they would. In some photos, you see remoras, pretty decent sized ones. But in my mind, that was not something that I would have necessarily thought to bring back.
That's definitely true. I've considered whether you'd want to eat a remora, and I usually decide no, definitely not.
I would side with you on that. And that's another point is we don't know if it's just they happened upon the remora and they just brought it back and then tossed it, or if they really did fillet it up.
Right. Yeah. So you said you were able to get size from these photos as well. Is that because the place where they're displaying them is still available for you to measure?
So the leaderboards, which is that, you know, wooden frame that the fish are displayed, they're no longer there. However, we have the opportunity to use an open source image software called ImageJ. And this allows you to measure not unknown lengths using like a pixel conversion.
Relative measurements.
Yeah.
We use that with Otoliths a lot.
Yeah, I've heard it used with Otoliths and also fish eggs, since you can draw like shapes with ImageJ. And so what we're using to scale the photos is actually the 2x4 and 2x6 lumber of those leaderboards. So we're using that to convert a pixel length to an inch length. We're pilot testing this methodology as well. And we're starting with a single species, king mackerel. And then as we move forward in the project, and if we receive additional funding, we'll be able to expand this out to different species.
So right now you're only measuring king mackerel?
Correct.
But identifying everything?
Yeah. Yep. So the citizen scientists are the ones that are going to be identifying the fish and counting them within Zooniverse. And the project staff, myself and Julia Bird, our project manager, are going to be the ones that are measuring the fish. We have some additional analysts too that we brought in that needed something to work on during COVID because we've been trying to kind of help out everyone else in the field. So we brought on two additional analysts. But yeah, we're going to be doing that in-house. We've talked about possibly incorporating that as a task for our citizen scientists, but I think that's further down the road.
So how did this project come about initially?
Rusty Hudson, he's a retired commercial and for-hire captain out of Daytona, Florida. And he approached the council with this really large bank of historic family photos. Rusty's really involved in the council process. He's a member of the Snapper Grouper and Cobia Mackerel Advisory Panels. And he really saw the value that these photos represented. He started working with Ken Brennan, and Ken is the coordinator for the Southeast Region Headboat Survey. And they really got the ball rolling on this project. And then the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council rolled into that project development. And then in 2019, we received a NOAA Fisheries Information Systems grant, and we got to work. They brought me on in July of 2019 and kind of showed me the ropes. They had gone to a Zooniverse conference and decided on the Zooniverse platform. And then we just got straight to building the project.
What do you hope that we can take away from these new data sets?
I mentioned that data gap before these dedicated catch monitoring programs began. So hopefully the data we collect can help fill that gap. So knowing the species, the number, and the size of the fish caught over time is really crucial in understanding the health of the fish population. And so this is a pilot project. We only have photos from Daytona Beach, Florida. But if our methods are effective and we receive more funding, we would really like to expand the project and kind of fill that gap within the entire South Atlantic region.
How do you imagine that these data will be able to shape new management measures?
It's our hope that they will be able to really better inform stock assessments. And hopefully it will do this by creating a better and more well-informed baseline for these assessments. The assessments help to create management plans. The council is making these fisheries management plans according to the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And we want to make sure that the data is useful and able to be incorporated. And we're using several measures to make sure that this is done. We have replications that are built into Zooniverse. So Zooniverse allows us to pick how many citizen scientists view each photo. We also have a validation team made of scientists and fishermen that will help kind of validate when there is not much agreement by the citizen scientists of what is appears in the photo. So then we'll kind of kick it over to our fish ID experts. For the length analysis portion, we've been performing precision and accuracy tests to make sure that the measurements that we're getting are, you know, sound and we're using the best method that we can.
How many people do you hope to incorporate as citizen scientists in this project?
As many as we can.
Do you have any kind of estimate of possible numbers?
Right now, when I look at the project, we currently have 10,000 classifications right now, and we've had around 700 volunteers participate in the projects thus far. Because Zooniverse is online, it allows people to kind of come in and come out of the project. I think it's really flexible to incorporate as many people as we can, because you can get on and, you know, analyze two photos and hop off and then come back. So there's not really like a, you know, dedicated window that you have to spend classifying these photos. So it's super flexible as far as participation goes.
Is there like a list of possible species? So I'm thinking about like somebody participating in this project from South Africa or something, and they don't actually know what species are possible in the South Atlantic. Is there like a drop-down menu or is it completely open?
So we've broken the species identification task into two main areas. So we have the most common species that you see in the photo, and we've chosen the four most common. And we give you a small picture of that species, and then you're able to mark it on the photo. We chose that mark tool because they are so numerous. You can just click, 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 and you don't have to count each individual fish and lose count. And for someone unfamiliar with those species, we have a really nice kind of training material bank called the Field Guide. And this provides the user with information on those most common species and how to identify them and distinguish them from others. And then once they've identified those four species, they're given a list of any other possible species that we've identified in the photo set. And you can choose any of the other species that are a little less common than those four.
So there is sort of a species bank.
Yeah. And even on the less common species, we have example photos from the photo set so that you can see what that species looks like in a black and white, kind of a little bit grainier photo.
You know, yeah. I did a lot of video ID, and that was always a real challenge to be able to sort of translate in your brain what a fish in a field guide looked like versus what the fish on the video underwater in natural light looked like.
Oh, it's, yeah, for sure. And I consider myself like a seasoned veteran of fish identification. I had a base knowledge coming into this project, but a lot of the time I'd look at these photos and I'd say, I know that's a cobia and not a shark, but I have no idea how to explain that to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's the black and white really presents a challenge. It's not impossible when you're identifying fish and kind of have to use what you have.
Yeah, I've really found, especially, and I'm sure black and white above the surface is similar, but especially in the underwater setting, I really found that I needed to train my brain to translate color or even ignore color to some degree and just look at shapes and shading and differences and that sort of thing, rather than what we normally go to in our brains is always color.
For sure. And with these photos, I mean, sometimes you don't have the luxury of even looking at fin shape, because the fish is either its tail is obstructed by another fish, or, you know, the anal fins collapse, where you would say, okay, you know, I know this fish has a pointed, you know, anal fin, but it's collapsed to the body, so you can't see it. So, and a lot of times the information will be valuable if we can get people to identify, you know, I know this is a grouper, I have no idea what kind because it's discolored or it's turned away from the camera, but I know it's a grouper. So we're always encouraging people to, you know, give an educated guess. There's times where my team and I have sat and looked at a picture. I mean, we did this the other day. We were like, what is this? You know, we've stared at it. I've circulated it around the office. It's essentially, at the end of the day, your best guess.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council in general? Our fishery management structure in the U.S. is maybe a little bit convoluted. Is that fair to say?
And the more you dive into it, the more acronyms there are, and the more agencies, it's quite confusing, especially, you know, coming from the outside in. And you're not alone if you didn't know who the council was. When I was doing my master's degree, to be honest with you, I had no idea who the council was and what their role was in fisheries management. So you're not alone. South Atlantic Fishery Management Council, or SAFMC, it's easier to shorten it down to the acronym. So we're headquartered in Charleston, South Carolina, and we're responsible for managing federal fisheries from North Carolina to the Florida Keys. We're responsible for managing those federal waters, and that's from 3 miles to 200 miles, or the exclusive economic zone, or the EEZ. The council's made up of 13 voting members, which include representatives from each of the states within that region, and then representatives from the commercial sector and the recreational sector, as well as NOAA representatives. They create fisheries management plans, and they amend those plans within the region as outlined by the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation and Management Act. And the council, it really thrives off of public participation. So we have public comments on all of our meetings. We're actually having a meeting this week. We urge people that want to get involved in your state's federal fisheries management to participate in, you know, these meetings and to get involved during those public comment periods. We're a little different from NOAA in that we propose management measures to the federal agencies. However, NOAA, who is federal, they create the laws. We're having all of these representatives come together, and at these meetings, they talk about, you know, proposed management changes and measures, and then that is put on the federal agency.
You were hooked on fisheries and fishing from an early age. Can you tell us a little bit more about what got you interested in the field in the first place?
I feel like I've always kind of been drawn to the water. We have photos of me dressed in adult scrubs as a 10-year-old in the stream behind my grandmother's house with a minnow trap. I realized also very early on that in my education that I, you know, science was where I excelled. And in high school, I had a professor suggest that I attend a lecture in Baltimore by Carl Safina, and he is a ecologist and conservationist. And he's a really very successful author. And he wrote a book called Song for the Blue Ocean. I just slammed through that book. He talked about that book in the talk that he was doing in Baltimore. And I think that's really when I got hooked on fisheries, because he does such a fantastic job of presenting the complexities that are involved in fisheries. The Pacific salmon fishery that he talks about, there's the people that fish, there's fisheries scientists, there's the dam and power companies, there's the tribes, and so many people have so many different goals for that fishery. And it's not just kind of black and white and cut and dry. You know, when I met Chip, now the Deputy Director of Science, one of the first things he mentioned to me was that managing recreational fisheries was so difficult because there's so many different goals. Commercial fishing, you go out and you try to catch as many fish as possible. With a recreational fishery, there's just so many different goals. You might have somebody wanting to catch trophy fish, you know, catch and release fish, or catch to harvest and eat. And because of all those goals, managing becomes very difficult.
Right. And in our region, it's huge. Especially, I'm not exactly sure about the numbers in the South Atlantic, but in the Gulf, many of the major fisheries are split 50-50. Mm-hmm. So, you really have a huge proportion of the total catch that's going to a recreational sector.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's the same in the South Atlantic.
You did your undergraduate degree at Coastal Carolina University in Myrtle Beach. What made you decide to attend Coastal?
So I think at first it was just moving out of my tiny little farm town in Maryland. And I really loved growing up there. But when I turned 18, man, my bags were packed and ready. I wanted, an adventure, and I wanted to be close to the water. But really, the program was everything that I wanted for my education. They have a pretty broad degree there. A lot of people, when I first went in, they were like, oh, you're going to be, become a marine biologist. And, everyone always shoots towards marine mammals first, which is fine, or sharks. And I have a lot of friends who did really great shark research. So, and I love sharks. They force you to get a marine science degree. So you had to have the background in physics and calculus and stat, biology and chemistry. And then you had to take all of those classes again within the marine science department. So it was, marine chem, marine bio. I felt like I really got a real well-rounded degree and kind of base knowledge of everything that would prepare me.
What do you think was your favorite course at the time?
I took a course on fisheries and aquaculture. And when I went into undergrad, I didn't know really anything about aquaculture. And I think it was still, and it still is, a pretty new, well, it has ancient roots, but in modern day, technology is emerging and people are still doing a lot of research with aquaculture. I had no idea about any of the techniques, and I think it's really cool to look at how they're making it more sustainable and environmentally friendly, because it can be very unsustainable and very not environmentally friendly.
You got your master's degree online from Johns Hopkins. Can you describe a little bit more about that degree?
I had just gotten married and my life was a little hectic, so I knew I wanted to do online. And so I actually found a program in Montana, but they required the GRE. My test scores had expired. And I was like, there's no way 27 that I'm going to be able to retake this test any better than I took it the first time.
In my experience, taking it at an older age was actually a benefit.
After I realized that the GRE had expired, I was kind of just bummed out. And my husband actually was like, stop being a Debbie Downer. And he found the program at Hopkins that I ended up enrolling in. And to be honest with you, I'm really glad that he found it. So the degree was in environmental science and policy. And so I was really specific with my undergrad, and I wanted to broaden my horizons for my master's degree. So this, I took landscape ecology, I took wetland ecology, I did some marine stuff as well, but the policy was really what drew me to the program, because I had never studied. I mean, we had breezed over policy stuff when it applied to what we were learning, but these courses really broke down like how the federal government manages these natural resources. I really appreciated that portion of the project, and learning how to read and interpret court cases was a whole new challenge for me.
What did you think about doing a degree completely online?
There were parts of it that I absolutely loved, especially after I had my son. but there were also, I had never done any online courses. So there was definitely some disconnect that I didn't love. All of the professors that I had at Hopkins were really great and really communicative. So I felt like I was still able to ask all of the questions that I needed to ask to make sure that I was understanding the material. I do definitely prefer an in-person learning style, but I think at the time of my life, this program fit the best. And there were times where I would do coursework at night after he fell asleep. And mm-hmm. that was the only time that I could get stuff done. So
yeah, I did my entire PhD while my kid was asleep. Every time he went to sleep, I would work. So what is your favorite memory from your education or your career so far?
Hopkins required you to do a field study. So you could either study in DC on their campus, or you could do like a field trip course. I chose to take a conservation biology class in Glacier National Park.
Ooh, wow.
So, yeah. We did some online coursework, and then we spent a week kind of hiking through the park, and each day they would have a different expert come in and talk about how, you know, what their work was in conservation biology. And we had somebody that worked with bears and wolverines and a horticulturist. And then of course, someone who worked in the fisheries with the park, which was obviously my favorite. He talked a lot about the brown trout and lake trout situation with in some of their lakes up there. A whole rigmarole, if you want.
Brown trout invasive there?
So the lake trout are invasive, and they introduce the lake trout, and they're kind of decimating the brown trout population. And he talked about introducing juvenile brown trout, and he said that they would dump these young fish into the lakes and watch the lake trout just devour them.
And so
in a lot of the reason that the lake trout were introduced was because they kind of pack a bigger punch when you're fishing for them. It was motivated by increasing that recreational fishery. So it was really interesting to me. That's obviously what I took away from the trip, but Glacier was absolutely beautiful. If you ever get the opportunity to go there, I highly recommend it.
If money were not an issue, what's one project you would love to work on in the future?
You know, I've read so much about the Pacific salmon, and I think it would be so cool to work on like the Snake River doing salmon studies. When I was mulling this over, I think it was split between that and I really love reef fish and coral. I've kept them for a little bit in an aquarium, and I think I would really love to be part of work that they're doing on the Great Barrier Reef. I know that they're doing a lot of both fishery and coral work there.
You said you're an avid angler as well. What's your favorite fish to target and catch?
So I think that on the saltwater, redfish or red drum.
My master's thesis was catch and release in red drum.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think one of the highlights of my angling career was catching a tagged red drum.
Yay! We put so many tags out.
Yes. I went online and I entered the tag number. They sent me a shirt and they sent me information on where the fish had been. And I was just like over the moon. That information was so cool to me. We used to catch them actually on a dock out on Church Creek behind Wadmalaw Island, and the dock was really tall, and we would watch them come in and just pitch straight to them, and you could see them hit the bait. I just love fishing for them. We do a lot of freshwater fishing. I can't say that I don't just absolutely love throwing, you know, anything to a bass and catching the bass. I think that's an oldie but a goodie. I can't ever complain about catching a bass, so. When I'm on the freshwater, I'll take it.
You're also a hobby aquarist. Why do you like keeping an aquaria?
I really love, especially some of the bigger fish that we have. I mean, I really consider them pets. I mean, we've named a couple of the bigger ones, and they beg for food, and they, you know, react when you come in the room. But I just absolutely love having the aquariums in my house. I like creating a really like naturalistic aquarium like you would see at an actual aquarium. And I have a couple of vivariums as well. I just like to create that naturalistic, you know, look inside of a tank. And we have the two types of cichlids, and it's just relaxing to see them, you know, swimming around, and it helps me decompress after a long day.
And of course, you have a kid, a small child in your house as well. It seems like he is on the go with you a lot, that you guys are out doing all kinds of stuff. What do you think his favorite activity is outside?
I really think he enjoys fishing a lot. He will throw the rod out and make the sound effects for the line going out, the swooshing, and he really enjoys reeling in. We haven't had him catch a fish yet because he's only two, but he enjoys being on and around the water. And it's so cool because my husband grew up in Michigan and I grew up in Maryland, but not really anywhere near the water. And so raising him where we live is something that we're really enjoying doing. We actually found a small creek behind our house.
That's, oh, nice.
And we're pretty far from the ocean. I mean, we're about 30 minutes from the ocean, but we found out that this creek is filled with tiny shark's teeth. And we've been in quarantine. It's been a really nice, like, just quick walk. We go find shark's teeth, and he just really enjoys just digging in the mud.
So you go fishing with him and go shark toothing and stuff, and kayaking too?
So he's still small enough where he sits in my husband's, well, he doesn't really sit, he stands, in between my husband's legs in his boat. He has to have his hands in the water constantly, and he likes to try to call the fish in.
Does it work?
You know, it has not worked yet. We're fingers crossed that it might. We were kayaking on the Ashley one time, and I was in front of my husband, and some other people passed us in a kayak. And they were like making some very concerning remarks. And I turned around, and Camden had fallen asleep, flopped over the side of the boat with his hands in the water. I'm sure that the people that passed us, they were like, there's a dead child in that boat and they're going to go dump it. And he just wore himself out playing in the water.
Oh my God, that's so funny. So, Allie, now the tough part of the interview is over, and it's time for my final three questions. My first question is always about sort of your favorite fish. Scientists, including Milton Love, have said that you're not a real scientist unless you tattoo your study species on your body. So, do you have any fish tattoos?
I guess technically, yes. I have a starfish tattoo that I got in undergrad. It was my first tattoo. It's just really simple. It's just like an outline of a starfish. However, I've been planning to get another tattoo soon. I haven't picked the species yet, but there's a quote when you enter the Baltimore Aquarium that says, "If there is magic in this world, it is contained in water." And I absolutely completely forget the person who said the quote, but I absolutely love that quote, and I've always wanted it tattooed on me and to include, you know, some kind of fish species with that. So yeah, I'm planning one. Not yet, but I'm getting there.
What is your dream job or location?
You know, I was mulling this around, and I absolutely love fisheries management, and I really like living in Charleston. And I think if I could find something here, that would really be what I would want to do. You know, find something permanent. I'm on grants right now. So if I could, you know, really settle into a career here, that would be, I think, a really cool move for me. But I've been to Montana, but I've never been to the West Coast. And I think, you know, working out there with a whole new set of species, you know, in Washington or, you know, Northern California, really anywhere, I think would be a cool adventure. I wouldn't be opposed.
Finally, if there was one point or principle you would have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think it would be to never not introduce yourself. I kind of started with the council as like the weirdo grad student in the back of the room asking random people questions and like awkwardly introducing myself to people and like grappling for an opportunity. But it's really led to me meeting some amazing people, working with some amazing people. I guess never, you know, let a, you know, an introduction slip by, because you never know who you're going to meet and what they're going to introduce you to or who they're going to introduce you to. I really feel like so far making connections has been crucial for my career and, you know, learning.
Ally, thank you so much for chatting with me. If people want to find out more about the Fishery Project online, how should they get in touch?
We have a webpage at the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council's webpage. So that's safmc.net. We have a citizen science page. You can find Fishery under there, or you can just search Fishery on the website, the council's website. We have a direct link to the project there. You do need to make a Zooniverse account before you can log on to the project. It's really easy, free, and you can opt out of getting the 1,000 emails.
Fantastic. And we'll link everybody up in the show notes to direct link to the project. If people want to contact you online, how should they get in touch?
Yeah, you can email me at Allie, A-L-L-I-E dot Iberle, that's I-B-E-R-L-E at safmc.net.
Thank you for listening to this 74th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fishvecchio. The podcast is Fisheries Pod. On Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. Don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, always introduce yourself.